My name is Arham Alam, and this is Swamp Talk, where we swamp the talk and talk to swamp. Today, I have Dr. Absar Mirza with me to discuss the pandemic, the ramifications of the pandemic, how the United States will move forward in terms of the pandemic, and what we can expect from a medical perspective. So, Dr. Mirza, thank you so much for talking to me tonight. Really grateful for it.
Thank you for inviting me to your blog.
Okay, thank you. So, what I'm my first question is going to be regarding the medical community's response to the pandemic. How would you evaluate the medical community's response? Would you say it was adequate, given the circumstances, or do you like where were shortcomings that you noticed?
Okay, I think you've already laid out the context. So depending, right? So what the context is and what resources we have.
I see.
I think based on that, our response was very robust. It was very swift. And, you know, like the rest of the nation and rest of the world, you know, we did not know what to expect, right? So it was a totally a new virus for us.
I see.
And we really didn't know what to expect. So we tried to learn about the disease while actively managing it. It's just like I would use an analogy that like you're building a plane while you're flying,
while you're flying
it, right?
Yeah.
So could we have done better? I think nationally we could have done better if there was better coordination of our efforts and information sharing. I think we could have easily made improvements early on. Because you know, it seemed like everyone was so consumed with the emergency that people were working in silos. But unfortunately, there is no national health system that can deliver that kind of response in the U.S., unlike many other European countries.
I see. So could you elaborate further on the type of national healthcare system that European countries have that that like have shown that system is possibly preferable to the current one we have now?
Yeah, so I want to just focus on the pandemic right now. I don't want to get into the, you know, other details of the health system, but like let's use the example of UK's National Health Service, the NHS,
yes.
Right? So that is the sole provider of healthcare to every single person that resides in UK. So they have the you know, the biggest picture of every single patient that is suffering from the disease and what their outcomes are. And that's where data comes into play. So, you know, they have a very coordinated effort when they're doing anything. So maybe you're good, maybe you're bad, maybe it's positive or negative. Like, you know, you can capture all the intervention, then it is outcomes. And you can control how you will allocate the resources. So it's not a hodgepodge of a small network of hospitals that are trying to do maybe reinventing the wheels or maybe trying to emulate in someone else. So it's one response, one treatment, and looking for the same outcome for the whole nation.
I see. Okay. So regarding health systems to a certain extent, but more public health and the our own government's response to the pandemic, how would you, because clearly there has been a lot of, obviously, political fighting regarding what is the best response to the pandemic. How would you actually, in a sense, evaluate the government's response to it? Where could they possibly have, where could they possibly improve? What could they possibly improve on moving forward?
So if you ask me to respond that in one word, I would say the response was very poor.
I see.
And I say that because there's lack of coordination amongst the leading healthcare agencies. We kept getting conflicting messages. And even to this day, you know, we are getting very conflicting advice. It keeps changing.
I see.
And they keep contradicting themselves. And I think there was a lack of sound leadership. And then, like, you know, the politics got involved. Which I think is the last thing you want to do. I think the scientific community should not be pressurized into any kind of politics.
Actually,
it was, I think, total chaos. And even today we can do much better, and we could have done much, much better than what we did.
I see. Okay. I can definitely understand that. I did actually have a quick question, though, regarding statistics. So I understand that the Trump administration, they recently, I believe they directed the Center for Medicare and Medicaid to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but to record the statistics regarding COVID-19 hospitalizations rather than the CDC. Can you explain the rationale behind that change?
Yeah, I think what my understanding is, they want to allocate resources based on what the hospitals are dealing with. So I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with that, with the concept. So since Medicare would approve the funding for many hospitals for Medicare and Medicaid patients, CMS, I think it's not unreasonable for them to directly look at it, if that's what the intent is.
I see. Okay, that makes sense, because I know at least I remember a couple of weeks ago there was a somewhat of an outcry, per se, if you will, regarding that the change in their database. So I was a little bit confused about that. But this is definitely very informative to know. Thank you.
And the other thing is the hospitals have to furnish those information. You may require additional personnel to do that. And many hospitals that are already financially struggling, for them, it is a big deal. And because they can't afford to do all those things, regulatory work and all this data collection that they're asked to do and furnish to the CMS. So that puts them in a bind.
Yes, I see. It puts the the poorer hospitals in a bind?
Yep, exactly. Because it requires resources basically to come up with all that information to track it down and hand it to the CMS.
Okay. I did actually want to talk a little bit about the poorer hospitals and possibly your hospital as well. Have they opened up, have they started doing elective surgeries again?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So now is this a nationwide trend, or is it just statewide at the moment?
What are you referring to?
Elective
surgeries?
Yes, elective surgeries. Because I know...
They're up and running now, majority of the places. They may not be at 100% capacity.
Okay.
But they're, we're trying to get back to our normal, so...
I see. Because I was actually kind of curious about that when you mentioned poor hospital, because from what I understand, because of the pandemic and the need to... cancel elective surgeries, many poor hospitals, especially in rural areas, they had to shutter their doors because they simply they weren't profitable anymore, solvent in a sense. So that's interesting to know, definitely. So moving on in statistics, how has statistics and data collection proven to be useful for tracking COVID-19?
So I would say that medicine is in part its art and part its science, right? Yes. So in the science part is there's medicine is science, we already know that, but now in the 21st century, we have moved from just practicing medicine as medicine, because that's really not sufficient. So we heavily rely on robust data, statistics, processes, and the implementation science. So that has become an integral part of healthcare delivery. So, we have moved from this older model where you just learned to be a physician, then the care was delivered. So, but now there are many other components that have to be mastered by not only the physician, but hospital and healthcare systems. So to answer your question, on every step, you need data. It's all about having data, because that is how we decide in crucial processes like triaging the patient, who needs to come and get admitted to the hospital. So how are we making that decision? Part of the decision is, you look at the patient that becomes, your practicing medicine is in part at the time and say, he looks sick, he needs to come in. But then it is this statistics and data that inform us, like, you know, certain kind of patients who meet this criteria based on their vital signs or the blood count, like, you know, I'm just saying, for example, they're the ones who may benefit from closer observation in the hospital, whereas some other patients that we have looked at, like thousands of similar patients elsewhere across the country or maybe across the world, they would do better at home. So we let them be discharged. So what we are essentially doing is we are practicing pure statistics, probabilities, right?
I see. Yeah.
That's what we are doing. We are at any given time, physicians and, you know, healthcare providers, they're engaging in pretest probabilities and predictions. Basically, that's what we are doing. So statistics is now an integral part of healthcare and healthcare delivery. And even for the COVID-19 pandemic, as I said earlier, that we are still learning. And what we're learning is basically the epidemiology of the disease, because we don't have any definitive treatment. We are trying treatments, but that, again, requires data, right? Who is the right person for the certain kind of treatment? We don't know that yet. But the stats are going to help us to solve that puzzle as well.
I see. Thank you. So, how do you believe statistics, or like current statistics right now, could improve to help medical professionals?
Can you repeat the question again?
Like, how do you believe statistics can improve from its current state so that it provides better information for medical professionals dealing with COVID-19?
Yeah, so I think going back to our last question, right? So it will help us in understanding the epidemiology of the disease. You know, it will help us in a better diagnosis and then treatment as well, right? So if we know who is going to be really sick, that is all statistics. So we will have some predictor models, I'm hoping, within the next 12, 18 months that will guide us to decide, like, you know, who's going to be sicker. And based on that, we will, you know, render them treatment. And then we predict who is going to be responsive to the treatment. Hopefully we have some preventive treatment and the curative treatment as well.
I see. Okay. So you, essentially you're saying that with these forecasts, from what I understand, that would be helpful moving forward.
Yeah, definitely.
Correct? Okay, I see.
Yeah. Okay. We will be able to, you know, identify hotspots, tracing who came in contact, and all these kind of things, and, you know, be able to then isolate those segment of population and prevent the spread of the virus going forward.
I see. Okay. Now, I would like to look at this pandemic through a historical lens. So, in what ways is this current pandemic similar to the Spanish flu from the early 20th century?
Yeah, so some similarities and some dissimilarities, right? So, the Spanish flu, the amount of mortality was just mind-boggling, I would say. We had a million of peoples who died or succumbed to the virus worldwide. But, you know, right now, we haven't seen as many deaths just because the healthcare system has advanced, even though we do not have any preventive treatment and we do not have any therapeutic or curative treatment. So it's really amazing that how we have been able to manage the disease without having any specific treatment available. So what we are doing is we are providing what we call as the supportive care. Let's say your oxygen level goes down, we are able to deliver oxygen, we can put you on the ventilator, and we know better how to treat patients on the ventilator. Our mortality has improved over the last few decades, and we have become better and better at what we have been doing for the last half century. So I think our supportive treatments have improved. We haven't had that many people dying. I think if the virus had hit us, let's say 50 years ago, I think the outcomes would have been definitely much different.
Mm-hmm.
And but the only the similarity is like, you know, we were unprepared for the Spanish flu, and we were equally found ourselves unprepared for the COVID-19 as well. And we miserably failed in containing the effect of the virus or protecting ourselves from affecting us.
I see. Okay. And so, thank you for that. That definitely helped provide a lot of perspective on how we've dealt with pandemics before. So one last question I had is the recent, so what's been happening recently, from my understanding, in the government and also among other people, is this idea of herd immunity, in that I believe one of President Donald Trump's advisors, Dr. Scott Atlas, a radiologist, he was suggesting that in order to combat the coronavirus, we need to depend on herd immunity. And I've actually spoken to another doctor about this, and so from what I understand, Dr. Atlas was trying to approach the coronavirus similar to chickenpox when they had pox parties back in the 1950s or mid-20th century. Do you believe that's the right approach? And if not, why?
So first thing is, like, you know, we're not close to having herd immunity as a means of protecting ourselves from the virus as of yet. Will that become possible down the road? You know, we can all speculate. Problem is, when we are saying that it is okay to go and have ourselves exposed to the virus, which is fairly virulent, what it really does is, when there is an outbreak, it stresses our acute healthcare system. And society had different expectations in 1950 as opposed to in 2020, mm-hmm. where, you know, the expectation is that anyone who's sick, no matter how sick they are, that they will survive. So the burden of treating all the sickest patients in the intensive care unit and the hospital is so high that, let's say, if 1% of the population is currently infected and we want to promote herd immunity and get 5% of the population infected, by no means the healthcare system is prepared to provide care and treatment to such a large percentage of the population.
I see.
So we will actually overstress the hospitals, and we will have to make those difficult situations, like physicians and hospitals had to make in Italy, that mm-hmm. there will not be any hospital beds, there will not be any intensive care unit beds, and you will have to determine, and you will have to triage patients based on their probability of surviving when you choose to admit or say, you know what, we're sorry, we can't save your life, so just go home and be comfortable.
I see. Okay. Well, Dr. Mirza, thank you so much for joining me and doing this. I know you're exceptionally busy during these times, but I'm really grateful that you came to talk to me. And so thank you so much, sir.
Oh, thank you. It was my privilege to be on your podcast.
Okay, thank you. And to the listeners listening at home, make sure to stay tuned for more podcasts moving forward. Thank you so much, and have a good evening.